Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Theo Wilson wants us to have hard conversations about race, and he wants us to do it in person. Wilson might seem like an unlikely person to deliver that message as a poet and one who captured the title at the Erotic Poetry Slam in 2007, but the African-American poet and rapper is perhaps more famous for his stint as Lucius25, a white supremacist online troll. The experience opened his eyes to the humanity of people whose views he profoundly disagrees with.
His TEDx talk about the experience and the lessons he draws from it have had 1.6 million views online so far, and it's what brought him to Carroll University this week. He also stopped by our studio as well. Theo Wilson, it is such a pleasure and an honor to meet you. Thanks so much for coming over this morning.
Thank you for having me.
I loved your TED talk, and I wanted to start with the idea of conversation and how conversation for you is the key to making things better. It sometimes seems to me that conversation is what gets us in trouble.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, listen, I want to be clear on something about conversation. There are multiple levels to the beast that we deal with when it comes to racism. However, conversation can attack one of them very well, and that's interpersonal racism. Not so much institutionalized, but interpersonal. What you have is the ability to humanize yourself and make it clear and abundantly, at least a visual, that you are somebody who has the same concerns as somebody across the aisle from you. And that if you do it right, you find out that there's a lot more in common than there are that separate folks. And so I think that's what I meant by conversations being the key to at least building bridges.
So the idea that sitting down with somebody that you fundamentally disagree with in a lot of cases, how do you get past the things that you disagree with that person?
Well, you know, one of the things that I said in the TED Talk is we're talking about face-to-face conversations as opposed to online conversations. And that is because the cage effect, you can see this in road rage, anger management, right? When you're in what you feel is a contained environment, certain parts of the aggressive side of your personality become amplified. Well, the same thing happens over the internet. But once you're face to face with somebody and you see like them living and breathing in front of you, you're number one faced with the immediate threat of the person right there is something that kind of puts some people who are of a hateful mindset on their heels. And they have to reckon with the fact that this is a person who is a human being versus the internet. Because there's no immediate consequence for you saying something hateful. There's no immediate threat if you should traverse somebody's personal boundaries. These are deep-seated, tribalistic, instinctual issues. And that if we have the courage to have these kind of conversations with folks in person, we may be able to get somewhere in terms of interpersonal racism and solving that problem.
I was going to say, what you're talking about sounds an awful lot like what people used to call civilization,
you know,
like putting aside that tribalistic, very me-centered way of being in the world and thinking about somebody else.
Absolutely. Well, the problem is that the way race is set up in the country is a zero-sum game. It's always, if this person gains, I have to lose, and vice versa. I understand the zero-sum game when it was originated. But right now, we literally have technologically out-evolved all zero-sum games. And it's funny because a lot of the technology came from war, came from setting up a victory for zero-sum games, meaning there's got to be positive sum here. There's got to be a way that we all can win. And the things that cause structural racism in this country, the things that have been studied in terms of housing discrimination and the economic consequences of that, they drag the nation down competitively against other Western nations who don't have these kind of issues. So if an African American is in poverty because of generational deprivation, that's still an American that's in poverty. And that counts when it comes to our rating against other countries and what they have in terms of their markers of civilization. So if we can actually get past this, everyone benefits. And it's time that we started to have that conversation so it can transverse into other areas.
When you went underground and became sort of a white supremacist troll is pretty much what you did.
Yeah.
What surprised you the most about doing that? Because you basically walked the walk about what you're just saying about we have to have these conversations. You started by doing the trolling thing, but then kind of discovered some stuff about yourself.
Yeah, what I realized was that the folks who are in the alt-right generally are ultimately the victims of an educational system. And so I don't want to take them off the hook in terms of their own bigotry. Let's be clear on that. What I found was that this is the inevitable outcome of when you don't teach history the right way. There are things that you miss, and that when you have a set of rules like political correctness, a few generations down the line, the conditions that made the rules necessary begin to evaporate. So naturally, people begin to question the rules in and of themselves. What folks don't realize is that when you remove these barriers of saying words that harm people, when you remove the barriers that stop people from denigrating someone's humanity, the conditions that originated the rules arise again. And so when you attack that and you don't know the history behind that, that's something that is obviously destructive, and we have to figure out how to recontextualize our relationships in terms of the history that we're actually not that far removed from.
No, because we're not. Yeah. I mean, I'm not sure when you were born. I grew up in
born in the 80s, yeah.
Okay, I was born in the late 50s and grew up in the 60s and 70s. Civil rights movement, women's rights movement, those early days of those things, and seeing major changes happen, and then, of course, the backlash.
And the backlash. And that's kind of historically the cycle with America. The old folks say, and I don't want to be too crass here, but the old black folks say, the white man giveth and the white man taketh away. It's, you know, you can see the cycle happening after the Emancipation Proclamation. There was an era during the Reconstruction period up until 1877 where there were great advancements in black life, including the first black lieutenant governor ever elected in the state of Louisiana, Oscar Dunn. So that, I mean, you would never think that that would happen before 1900, and yet still it did. And then the betrayal of 1877 with the election of Rutherford B. Hayes brought in the Jim Crow era. People think Jim Crow started right after slavery. That's not true. There was this gap. And then so you have then the advancements made from the civil rights movement. And right after that, you have the expansion of the prison industrial complex, the new Jim Crow, the laws that criminalize basically survival behavior. So then that incarcerates so many African Americans, and we're still dealing with the fallout from that right now.
In this state, very, very much so.
I bet. I would love to hear more of that.
The highest rate of black male incarceration in the nation.
Wow.
In this state.
See what I'm saying? So, like, you know, and then you have, you know, in this era, following the first black president, you have this, what Van Jones called a white lash, those who felt oppressed somehow underneath Barack Obama. Now having, quote unquote, their say in the era that we see now. So, yeah, this is a cyclical thing. And once history is discovered like that, black folks have some interesting choices ahead of us in terms of how to deal with this cycle and getting out, because this cycle takes our lives, you know.
Well, what about white people like me?
Mm-hmm.
How do you suggest that, particularly the people on the alt-right, who have absorbed these ideas that are not constructive.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, conversations are wonderful, but what's the next step? How do you take it so that it becomes policy, it becomes civilization?
Well, I mean, you know, reality asserts itself. If you have an erroneous idea in your head about race and the value of human life, eventually, that will come to be corrected. What needs to be done, I think a lot of stuff is already becoming at least apparent in terms of action steps. The fact that, like, for example, after Charlottesville, there was great pressure in the country to classify white extremist groups as terrorists and to treat them as such. You know what I mean? That political will ain't going anywhere. That's on its way. What's being titled the Blue Wave this November's election season, if Alabama was any indicator on what the electorate is going to do, then, you know, we have a possible new wave of policymakers that will institute policy changes that will make certain punitive actions against those who are domestic terrorists, like folks who act in white supremacist ideology, make those measures stick. And so I think that's a good thing. But also in terms of the alt-right, I think a lot of them are starting to realize, you know, especially after Charlottesville, you guys are on the wrong end of history again. That's a tragedy. There's so much history to learn. This is the age of Google. You can find out anything you need to know. And if you don't take the steps to have some accountability in this, then you'll end up a hate criminal, and that will stick with you forever. You know what I mean?
But going back to what you've talked about a number of times about the echo chamber, you know, how do you get people out of their – whatever their echo chamber is, whether it's a very conservative one, a very liberal one where you think you're being open and progressive but you're not necessarily.
Yeah.
How do you get people outside of that echo chamber?
Well, the first step was to acknowledge that it exists. And I think one of the great things about my TED Talk is it seemed, and I don't know if I was in my own echo chamber with this, but it seemed like after the TED Talk hit, a lot more conversation around what echo chambers are and their consequences began to take place in the country. And once you realize that you're in a liberal echo chamber, then you have to figure out, okay, these folks who are conservatives are your neighbors. They're people that your children may date one day. You know what I mean? If you stop at condemnation, then what do you truly gain with that? You see what I'm saying? The issue is that the way the tribalization is with the country right now, I've seen the left be more honest and accountable with holding their standard bearers accountable than I've seen the right as of late. There's this fear, it seems, on the right to be intellectually honest about like the consequences of the Trump administration. Be honest about what it means that he can't keep any staff, including recently with the firing of Rex Tillerson. Like what it means that there seems to be a blame game going on that wants to indict everybody, but the person in charge and the people who put them there. And so that's going to have a cost. If you don't break out of your echo chamber, then the consequences when they hit will be that much more severe.
Severe for everyone.
For everyone.
Because we're talking about the structure of the country.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I have to say, you know, that's terrifying.
It is. And I have cousins, you know, who are black conservatives. You know what I mean? Like black conservative people who are married also to white conservative people. And a lot of conservative people are concerned about the actions of our supposedly conservative president, who was a limousine liberal up until 5 years ago. And what we find is that he has gotten to the point where he's learned a dangerous trick that he can get to the top of the news cycle if he dismantles the country from within. And that is dangerous because we've got too many enemies out here who are looking for a weakened state. And regardless of where you fall in terms of the spectrum of patriotism, we're all connected to this thing. And so we as a nation have to figure out the political atmosphere that got us in this kind of danger and make sure that we never cross that threshold again and figure out ways to work together across partisan lines. And I hope that that's what my talk can at least inspire people to do.
Well, also the other thing you do is Poetry Slam. And poetry is another very immediate way to talk to people. And that's one of the reasons you're here in Wisconsin as well, is to you're holding a Poetry Slam, aren't you?
I'm teaching kind of a workshop on how I did what I did. So the thing that got me on the TED stage was that they invited me in to be kind of a palate cleanser of a poet. And my poems were just terribly popular at those TEDx Mile Highs. But spoken word, you know, I started off as a rapper anyway. So rap is just rhythmic, aggressive poetry. I began to take my raps to poetry competitions and win them. And over time, I evolved into an actual slam poet and won the National Poetry Slam about 6 or 7 years ago. And so that opened up gates. And so it's just kind of this thing, this evolution from rapper to poet to speaker and performer.
Do you think that poetry as an art form is a way that we can talk to each other listen to each other?
Poetry's super immediate. Like when if you got a poetry venue, you know, you can have, you know, 200 to 300 people there sometime every week, you know. And with that, you have the chance to literally, if it's an open mic, you can write something and get your message out to 200 to 300 people like that. You know what I mean? Those people are all voters. Those people all hold sway in certain industries sometimes. You never know who's in the audience. And so, yeah, I have seen poetry change public opinion. And I think that it's a very, very powerful means, especially when you got a sitting audience and a culture that's already open to it.
Yeah, I think art always, in its best sense, speaks truth to power.
It does.
Always.
Yeah, and historically speaking, it's been the poets that have been the canaries in the mineshaft when social change is about to happen. You know, out-and-out revolutions have been kind of captured by poets in their art, you know, since time immemorial. So, yeah, poetry is one of those things. It distills language, which distills thought, which distills a zeitgeist if you do it right.
Do you consider yourself a canary in the coal mine?
I don't think I couldn't be. There's no way that I wouldn't be in terms of what's happening in our culture right now. I'm very grateful to have been allowed access to certain platforms to share what I know, because I think that when change comes, there's always a warning. And if it's going to be a negative change, then there's a warning before destruction. And hopefully I can aid in that. You can only shine the light. If folks choose to turn away, that's on them. But I'm here to shine whatever light that I have.
Well, Theo Wilson, we are so happy you are here to shine that light.
Thank you so much for having me.
Theo Wilson is a poet, rapper, and social activist. He spoke about his experience impersonating an online white supremacist troll at an event at Carroll University this week. There is a link to his TEDx talk about it at WUWM.com.